WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV. This broadcast is dedicated to bringing you the truth behind the news.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. Today's Tuesday, July 25th, and I'm your host, Paul Dragoo. Will Joe Biden and his Justice Department regret messing with Texas? Last week, the U.S. Department of Justice threatened to sue Texas if the Lone Star State didn't remove floating barriers to put in the Rio Grande River to stop illegal aliens from crossing over into the U.S. The Biden DOJ gave Texas until 2 p.m. this past Monday to comply. Well, Monday came and went, and Texas has refused to comply, and it looks like it has no intention of doing so either. Just before yesterday's deadline, in a letter to Biden, Texas Governor Greg Abbott said, "Texas will see you in court, Mr. President." In the letter, Abbott said he has asserted Texas' sovereign interest in protecting her borders and that all of this is happening because Biden violated his constitutional obligation to defend the United States against invasion. Abbott also mentioned humanitarian concerns in his letter, telling the president that, quote, "Neither of us wants to see another death in the Rio Grande River, yet your open border policies encourage migrants to risk their lives by crossing illegally through the water instead of safely and legally at a port of entry. Nobody drowns on a bridge," end quote. Before Biden's de facto open border policies, President Trump prioritized securing the border. Trump administration efforts included building a wall. Though leftists decried those efforts as anti-humanitarian, the truth, as is usually the case with leftist narratives, is the opposite. Open borders are anti-humanitarian. When Trump was president, he appointed Tim Ballard to the Public-Private Partnership Advisory Council to end human trafficking. Ballard is the character played by Jim Caviezel in the new hit movie Sound of Freedom, which addresses child sex trafficking. Here's Ballard explaining what a difference the wall can make.
Thank you so much, Mr. President. Thank you very much. I spent 12 years as a special agent, as an undercover operator, working on the southern border, working sex trafficking cases. And I can tell you, you're exactly right. One little girl I can tell you about, in fact, I introduced this little girl to Ms. Trump during a private briefing. This little girl was kidnapped in Central America, 11 years old, groomed for 2 years, with the intent of getting her ready to come to America. Why? Because we are the highest consuming nation of child pornography. We are the clientele that's the big money. They brought this little girl through a part of the southern border where there was no wall, easily got her to New York City, and this is hard to hear, but this is the truth, and everyone needs to hear this. This little girl, and this is a very typical, raped for money every day, 30 to 40 times a day. If that's not a crisis, if that's not an emergency, I don't know what is. Now, let me say this. Had there been a wall, had there been a barrier, this little girl likely would have been saved, because the traffickers would have been forced to take this child through the port of entry, where we have amazing law enforcement. I've worked with these people. These are the best people on the planet. They can detect, they have equipment, they have trained agents. In contrast, while this was happening, I was working another case. A little boy, a Mexican boy who was kidnapped by an American trafficker, by a child pornographer. He kidnapped Mexican children, brought them to San Bernardino County, where he had a makeshift studio, made child porn with these little children, 5 years old. This little boy was kidnapped in Mexicali, Mexico, where there was a wall, where there is a barrier, and so he was forced to take this little boy through the Calexico port of entry, and guess what? It worked. We captured him. We rescued the little boy, and subsequently rescued 12 other children in San Bernardino, California. The difference between those two cases is 2 + 2 = 4. The wall was the difference.
Joining me to discuss today's stories is editor-in-chief of the New American magazine, Gary Benoit. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Paul.
Man, we've really been on this. And, you know, one of this high ground, this moral high ground that the left always tries to capture, this is a perfect example of how, again, it's the opposite of what they say. This is huge, this human trafficking. And this is something that Trump was discussing. If there's at least one reason to put a wall, to stop that, you could say this is it.
Absolutely. And like you said, what the left is saying is the opposite of reality, because they portray securing a border as being anti-humanitarian. And as you said, Paul, it is exactly the opposite. Now, in your news segment, you refer to a letter that Governor Abbott wrote on July 24, just yesterday, to Joe Biden. And I'd like to quote another segment of that letter, which deals with the humanitarian crisis. And this is what Governor Abbott had to say to President Biden. "It has been under your watch that migrants have suffered an unprecedented crisis of humanity. 2 years before Texas deployed the floating marine barriers, and a year before it deployed Concertina Wire, a United Nations agency declared that the border between the United States and Mexico is the deadliest land crossing in the world, with 728 migrant deaths recorded in 2021. Now, it goes on with other examples. I won't keep reading.
Yeah.
But again, the left takes the truth and turns it on its head.
Yeah, yeah, that's usually what they do. And it's it reminds me of, you know, I grew up as a Christian and whatnot, and one of the things we learned was that the devil, he's what is it, the father of lies, a deceiver,
yes,
right? And so there is, we keep seeing over and over, and even in the next stories, we're going to see where what they say is a lie, and the truth is the opposite of what they say. I wanted to bring this up before moving to our next story. Is actually, the Biden administration ended a family DNA testing system recently. Do you remember that on the U.S.-Mexico border? And
yes,
it makes you, and a lot of critics were saying, it's like, well, this is going to make it even easier to traffic children, because now there's no DNA, the DNA restrictions there. They would have played a role in that, saying it's like, whoa, this isn't your, you know. And so it makes you wonder, it's like, it's almost like they want human trafficking to happen. I'm not saying that's necessarily the case, but it's like, you got to wonder.
Well, I'm going to stick my neck out a little further and say that that is the case. And I wouldn't say it on the basis of that example alone, Paul. But when you look at U.S. foreign policy, and when you look at domestic policy, or you look at the policy along the border, none of these policies make sense unless you look at it through the prism of there being a conspiracy, there being an organized plan to subvert the United States of America for the purpose of bringing about totalitarian controls on a global scale. It doesn't make sense otherwise.
Right, absolutely. All right, let's look at our next story. First, they came for the gas stoves, and now the Biden administration is coming after dishwashers, hot water heaters, refrigerators, and even ceiling fans. In May, the Department of Energy, or DOE, published a proposal for new so-called efficiency standards. The new standards promise to not only make dishwashers ineffective, but also make them so expensive that you'll need a home improvement loan to buy one. As the DOE is plotting the best ways to harm American consumers, it's also assuring us that its new rule will save us a pile of money in utility bills. This reminds me of a famous quote from former President Ronald Reagan.
The nine most terrifying words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help."
Terrifying indeed. Last Friday, the DOE announced a draft proposal that would require hot water heaters to use heat pump technology. That means heat from the surrounding air is used to warm up the water, which explains why heat pumps are only popular in hot climates. But wait, there's more. They're also targeting generators. The U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission is proposing to ban nearly all portable gas generators, despite the fact that they really come in handy during emergencies. The new rule even prevents manufacturers from stockpiling non-compliant generators before the rule goes into effect. And let's not forget the policies that Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm proposed in February, crippling clothes washers and refrigerators with new energy-efficient standards, and in April, shackling air conditioners with the same. In March of 2022, the Biden administration also rescinded a Trump-era rule that made it more difficult for the DOE to update appliance energy conservation standards. We should have seen this coming. On his first day in office, Joe Biden signed an executive order requiring DOE to undo anything Trump did that promoted the free market and cast aside rules related to climate change nonsense. One of his goals included major revisions to the federal government's energy conservation program for appliance standards. At the time, a former Trump DOE official told Fox News that the updates would only translate to higher-priced appliances with very little, if any, consumer benefits. But Biden's executive order stressed that the main focus is not helping consumers, but battling climate change. In other words, tackling a problem that doesn't exist. Here's Kentucky Republican Representative Thomas Massie questioning former U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, who now serves as Biden's special envoy for climate. This happened in 2019 during congressional testimony and exposes the hoax of demonizing carbon dioxide.
Let me ask you this. What's the consensus on parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere?
About 406, 406 today.
Okay, 406. Are you aware
350 being the level that scientists have said is danger.
Okay, are you aware? 350 is dangerous. Wow. Are you aware that since mammals have walked the planet, the average has been over 1,000 parts per million?
Yeah, but we weren't walking the planet. Let me just share with you that we now know that definitively at no point during the least the past 800,000 years has atmospheric CO2 been as high as it is today.
The reason you chose 800,000 years ago is because for 200 million years before that, it was greater than it is today. And I'm going to submit for the record.
Yeah, but there weren't human beings. I mean, there was a different world, folks. We didn't have 7 billion people.
So how did it get to 2,000 parts per million if we humans weren't here?
Because there were all kinds of geologic events happening on Earth which spewed
up. Did geology stop when we got on the planet?
Mr. Chairman, this is just not a serious conversation.
Your testimony is not serious.
Gary, I love that because you take them off their talking points, you start introducing other factors, and you expose the fraudulent narrative that they're spewing, and all of a sudden, you know, they start talking, you know, they start deflecting with things like that.
Yeah, he didn't know what to say, did he?
Right. Geology didn't stop, yeah. Right?
Yep.
And this is what they do. They pick this little segment, they're saying it's like, it's skyrocketed, and then you're like, well, what about all the other times around? Mm-hmm.
Chris, I personally do question the age of the Earth.
Right.
I personally don't think it's that old. I don't think science has concluded that for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But that aside, Paul, CO2 is plant food. You
right.
can look at it that way. Well, without CO2, there would be no vegetation. There'd be no plants, and by extension, no life on Earth. Because could we survive without
right.
plants? The Biden administration and the powers that be are treating CO2 as this really dangerous pollutant.
Right.
And, of course, the whole thing is being used as a pretext for them to try to bring about the totalitarian controls. And what is happening in terms of going after home appliances, gas stoves and so forth, that's simply part of that stratagem.
And it's been for a while, hasn't it?
Oh, it's been for a while. For example, I have here an article that the New American published online back on September 30th, 2010, entitled Stealth Socialism, the EPA Takes Aim at House Appliances. And I'd just like to read the first paragraph. Your car and your light bulbs were not enough. The Environmental Protection Agency needs to throw its considerable weight around some more.
Yeah.
In an end run toward the finish line to impose a socialist America, the EPA, apparently the agency of choice to enforce a nanny state, is now taking aim at everyone's home appliances. Vacuum cleaners, dishwashers, refrigerators, high-definition televisions, microwaves, microwave ovens, residential and mobile home functions, fluorescent light fixtures, residential clothes washers and dryers, room and central air conditioners, and battery chargers.
Yeah. So they've always, or for a long time at least,
right.
at least 10, 15 years, they've been aiming to do this.
But remember not long ago, in fact, much more recent than when this article was published back in 2010, you just have to go back a year or so ago, when the claim was being made that this was a conspiracy theory, that this
right.
was ridiculous, the notion that they would go after your gas stoves.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a lie. And now they're going after a lot more than that.
They sure are. Thanks, Gary. Well, hey, folks, the John Birch Society is hosting our annual leadership conference this coming September. This year, we'll be gathering in Des Moines, Iowa. We'll be discussing effective strategies that you can use in your activism, and we'll bring plenty of tools that you can take back home with you. This will also be a great opportunity for us to meet you and for you to meet like-minded patriots who are working to restore America. Our keynote speaker will be Dr. Ryan Cole, whose discussion topic will be The Death of Science, Medical Freedom in an Era of Lies. James Patrick, the film director of the movie Nitrogen 2000, he'll also be there, and on Friday we'll be doing dinner and watching his movie. Former Iowa U.S. Congressman Steve King will join us as well, as will renowned physicist and election expert Dr. Douglas Frank. The New American's Alex Newman, he'll be there, and he'll be discussing how climate change is used to scare and control people, just like we discussed. And that's just a brief summary of everything that will be happening over those 2 days. Visit jbs.org and learn more about the Leadership Conference. You can also get tickets there online at jbs.org, or you can call 1-800-527-8721. But hurry up before the ticket window closes. Again, get your tickets at jbs.org or call 1-800-527-8721. Stay tuned, because we'll be right back with more stories.
In 1988, the John Birch Society produced a documentary so predictive, it's as though they had a time machine. Out of Control, Immigration Invasion was produced and hosted by investigative reporter William F. Jasper, and looks at the growing problem of unrestricted illegal immigration that, in 1988, already saw upwards of 10 to 20 million illegal aliens within the borders of the U.S. Unknown agents from around the world using the southern border as easy entry. Certainly, some are innocent families escaping hardship, but also certainly some are criminals, potentially terrorists. Is it not appropriate that there be some criteria for the entry of any sovereign nation? Why should the U.S. be different than Canada, Germany, Russia, Japan, or every other country on the planet? Out of Control, Immigration Invasion. Watch this time capsule of prescient wisdom at thenewamerican.com/out of control.
Welcome back. 2 months after the COVID emergency officially ended, the Biden administration is making it clear that it's preparing for the next pandemic. On Friday, the White House launched a new office that is supposed to oversee federal efforts to counter large-scale health threats. The new office will be permanent under the justification that pandemics will always be a threat. According to the White House, the Office of Pandemic Preparedness and Response Policy will be charged with leading, coordinating, and implementing actions related to preparedness for and response to known and unknown biological threats or pathogens that could lead to a pandemic or to significant public health-related disruptions in the United States. That sounds important. The new office will replace the existing COVID-19 response team and MPOX team at the White House, and it'll work on addressing potential public health outbreaks and threats from COVID-19, MPOX, polio, avian and human influenza, and RSV. So how do they plan to address these threats? You'll be shocked to learn that a new generation of vaccines and treatments are the answers to these upcoming pandemics, you know, like they were with the last one. The person tapped to lead the agency comes from the military. Retired Air Force Major General Paul Friedrichs now serves as Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Global Health Security and Biodefense at the National Security Council. Before that, Friedrich served on the Department of Defense COVID-19 Task Force. The administration's announcements of the new office comes as the World Health Organization is drafting a global convention on pandemic prevention, preparedness, and response. If supported by the members, the convention would transfer national sovereignty to the WHO during public health emergencies, whether they're real or fabricated. Needless to say, the Biden administration is completely on board with this agenda. At the same time, China is building new quarantine facilities. The globalists and the organizations they wield massive influence on see future pandemics as inevitable. Besides Biden's White House, Communist China, and the WHO, those include the United Nations, World Economic Forum, Gavi, and the head of the latter, Bill Gates. Our viewers remember that Gates, together with the WHO and the Johns Hopkins Institute, foresaw in 2019 the COVID outbreak in their infamous tabletop exercise, Event 201. Last year, these same entities conducted a new simulation called Catastrophic Contagion in preparation for the new deadly outbreak expected in 2025. This is how they envision it.
Officials in two Latin American countries alerted the WHO of several outbreaks of a new infectious disease that's mysteriously appearing across the region, Severe Epidemic Enterovirus Respiratory Syndrome 2025. Over the past 6 weeks alone, there have been 500 confirmed or suspected cases reported. The virus could cause a severe pandemic if early containment and mitigation efforts are not successful.
As of today, there have been an estimated 1 billion cases worldwide, with more than 20 million deaths, including nearly 15 million children. Countless millions are alive, but left with paralysis or brain damage. The most successful countries are those which invested in preparedness and trained for this moment years in advance. This included having full-time pandemic preparedness and response teams, which conducted detailed operational planning and routinely tested those plans through exercises and drills. If more countries had participated and heeded the guidance, the toll might have been much less.
Well, Gary, don't you feel all warm and fuzzy knowing that you have all these figures and lots of money and power here ready to protect you from the next pandemic, you know, like they did the last one?
Yes, and and all the killings that they were responsible for with the last one, because we can't forget, Paul, that the last go-around with COVID-19, that many, many more people died as a result of COVID policies than died as a result of the disease itself.
Right. There's lots of experts who maintain that exact point.
Exactly. Of course, you have the policies that were put in place in the hospitals.
Right.
We could call them COVID hospitals, where basically they treated one disease. They were going in that direction and providing treatments that resulted in killing people.
Yeah. But then they also suppressed treatments that worked.
That's right. Treatments that worked and very inexpensive treatments, mm-hmm. such as ivermectin. So they did that, and of course the lockdowns were very health damaging. It also really harmed the economy, and of course that can have health effects as well when you destroy the economy.
Well, the lockdowns were shown to, and we warned that this would happen,
sure.
because not because we're geniuses or prophets, but because the data already exists. But we warned that the lockdowns, the isolation, would lead to increased depression, increased substance abuse, suicides, and that's exactly what happened. That's mainstream data that's already available.
Right, and there's also the wearing of the masks that were imposed in many areas across the country.
What harm did those do?
That was very, very damaging too. You know, particularly with young people, and that has effects up to today. Where you have people entering the school system who are having problems in terms of speech and relating with people and whatnot because of the mask.
Oh, wow. I didn't mm-hmm. know about that. But they also shuttered. They shuttered businesses, like mm-hmm. you had said. You know, they tanked the economy. I don't know what the number is now. Every time I check, there's a different number. But lots of businesses never came back. They never recuperated, which is odd because they shuttered the small businesses and then all the big box stores, they were
exactly.
all open and whatnot. And that's the only
right.
place you could get it.
And not just the big box stores, because Planned Parenthood kept operating.
Yeah, and the bars.
That apparently was considered an essential business.
Right.
But then you had other people who were considered non-essential workers. And, you know, their businesses were closed. And in fact, churches too. Churches shut down.
Yeah.
So isn't it amazing that you had a disease that would create a lethal hazard at churches, but not at Planned Parenthood centers?
Or at the bars?
But yet at Planned Parenthood, they're in the business of killing people. They kill innocent human life.
Again,
womb.
It's a topsy-turvy world in which mm-hmm. we live in. Everything is counterfeit. Everything seems like everything is a lie. And it's like we just experienced this. And to play the devil's advocate, clearly there are real viruses. There are real diseases. They can come, they can happen, and they can spread around the world. So it's obviously, we're not saying that's not the case.
Sure.
But are we saying that we have more reason to be afraid or to worry about what the government will do than what these diseases?
Absolutely. And of course, to make this understandable, we have to keep in mind that just like climate change that we talked about earlier, that problems either real or imagined, in the case of viruses or diseases, obviously there are such things, yeah. so that's real, but these things can be exaggerated and exploited for the purpose of bringing about the new world order that the would-be masters of the universe want to bring about. And I'd like to point, Paul, to a copy of the New American Magazine I have here, going back to November 24 of 1997. And on the cover, it says, "From Megatons to Microbes, Scaring Us into the New World Order." And if you turn inside the magazine itself, the title of the article, Scaring Us Toward Global Government. And I'd just like to read one sentence from this article. "Where once we were menaced by megatons, the danger now supposedly comes from microbes. And familiar voices are insisting anew that only world government can save humanity from destruction." Mm-hmm. Once again, we said that going back to 1997.
Yeah.
So, you know, the politics of these things is much more significant than the science.
We are pointing this out right now. Viewers and listeners should take note. This is, they're planning again, it looks like, and this is what they want to bring. The problem, I think, has been in the fact where we are now, because we have so many times warned and predicted that this is where it's going decades before, but it's never become mainstream. So I'm hoping that this time people have not such a short memory. And I'm hoping that COVID, the way they reacted in COVID, that alone has caused such a scar.
It's almost like they're running naked through the streets, Paul. It is becoming so obvious. But the good news is that people are seeing this and they're waking up.
Absolutely. Thanks, Gary. That's all for our news segment today, folks. For more Truth Behind the News, make sure to get a subscription to the New American Magazine. You can do so online at thenewamerican.com. Or you can call our office at 800-727-8783 Monday through Friday, and you can order your subscription that way. Stay tuned, because we'll be right back with more New American TV.
All right, parents, listen up. We've all seen the countless examples of how radical leftists have been destroying American schools. It's no longer just about the terrible math and reading levels. Now radical left teachers birthed from liberal universities are forcing gender indoctrination in kindergarten. They're teaching lessons on white guilt.
Freedom Project Academy has perfected live online learning over the course of a decade. I get a ton of great feedback about this program, a ton.
They're built on Judeo-Christian values, a classical curriculum. What does that mean? It means they're taught, your children are taught the way that the founding generations of the country. My own son, Noah, did Freedom Project Academy for several years when he was younger.
The more we tell our friends about these things, the more people will get on board. And I believe that we can be the catalyst to some real change.
We must save the West. Our way of life and our culture is under attack. And because of patriots like you and your project, I have optimism for the future.
Next up, Christian Gomez interviews Selwyn Duke about the decline of Christianity and the need to return to our religious roots. Let's watch.
This is Christian Gomez for the New American Magazine. And joining us today on the program is Selwyn Duke, a contributor for the New American Magazine. Selwyn has written several articles in the past few years for the New American on the topic of the decline of Christianity. And joining us here right now is Selwyn Duke. Thank you for joining us.
Christian, great to be with you. And I know that Christianity is not declining in your household because you're floating around in the ether there, but we're going to talk about the rest of us.
Yes, speaking of the rest of us, is the influence of Christianity waning in America right now? What is the state of Christianity at the present hour?
Yeah, well, Christian belief in the United States, Christian, has been waning for quite a number of decades now. I mean, just to give you some examples, and this is from Pew Research, which is a very good polling outfit, they now mention that people who identify as nuns, that means they have no religion whatsoever, they outnumber evangelicals. So their numbers have been increasing, like I said. Not only that, self-identified Christians now make up about 63% of the population. At least that's how it was in 2021. That's down from 75% just a decade earlier. And again, before then, before that prior decade, the number was even higher. So like I said, this is a long-term trend. And get this, Christian. Now in the United States, our pagans outnumber our Presbyterians. Think about that. When I say pagans, I mean Wiccans mainly. Wicca is all the rage nowadays, which of course involves, has to do with witchcraft. So anyway, we're seeing this decline in Christianity, and really we're following in the footsteps of Western Europe, where Christian faith started declining a long, long time ago. And what are the implications of this? That's the question. Well, first of all, if you're a believing Christian, you will be concerned about people's souls. We understand that. But looking at this in more of a worldly way, Christian, we have to understand there are other implications as well. For instance, one of the greatest indicators of voting patterns is church attendance. People who attend church regularly vote overwhelmingly Republican. People who never attend church vote overwhelmingly Democrat. And you see this in other parts of the world. For instance, in Western Europe, if you look at how atheistic nations are, you'll see a strong correlation between that and their level of what we call leftism. For instance, Sweden is probably the most atheistic nation in Europe, and it's also probably the most liberal. If you want to go beyond Europe, well, you look at China. It's the most atheistic nation in the world, and we know what state it's in politically. So this has some serious implications politically, socially, in many, many ways. And I don't want to go on too long, so if you want to chime in, just please do so. But I can go on and talk about actually the attacks on Christianity and why this is happening.
Yes, I wanted to ask you, what do you believe accounts for the decline of Christianity or the Europeanization of Christianity in the United States, if you will?
Yeah. Well, before I get to that completely, let me point out that there actually are attacks on Christianity. I don't think that's going to come as a shock to any consistent reader of The New American. But here's a good example. I wrote about this a while back. Professors George Yancey and David Williamson wrote this book titled So Many Christians, So Few Lions. Is There Christianophobia in the United States? And basically what they did for this book, Christian, was they interviewed pseudo-elites, and they found out that while Christianophobia, or Christophobia, as I think I would call it, is not common among the rank and file among average Americans. It's actually very, very common, de rigueur, among pseudo-elites. I mean, one of them actually said that Christians, quote, should be eradicated without hesitation or remorse, according to these two professors. But why is it declining? Okay, well, first of all, let's understand that one reason why people hate Christianity so much is it calls their sins, sins. It condemns things that they may have an affinity for and that they're loath to relinquish. And of course, no one likes anyone or anything that bursts his bubble. So that's a major factor for everyone. It's something, Christian, that causes people to embrace what someone close to me called designer religion, where instead of saying, okay, let's find out what the truth is and conform our lives to it, people say, well, this is the lifestyle I want to live. Now let me find a so-called religion that will accommodate it. But there are other factors too. Okay, first of all, there was a professor in England who made a very, very good point, I have to say. And he said, why do you see this process of diminishing Christianity occurring much faster in the United States than in Europe? And he said, one reason is that we have the internet today. And what happens with the internet is, years ago, if a young person was raised in a town, he usually would have to try to conform to the social structure of that municipality. There would be social pressure to conform. That was his social group. And generally, people in towns in America had at least some degree of faith. But now with the internet, what happens is young people find these social groups in the virtual world. And these groups may be atheistic, they may be hostile towards religion, you can find any kind of group you want. And so then the young person maybe has pressure to conform to that group and no longer is oriented towards his town the way it was before. But there are other factors as well. There are famous people who have come out as non-believers because the stigma attached to atheism is not what it once was, it just doesn't exist anymore. You have popular culture poking fun at faith at every turn. We know that. And also, a lot of people associate atheism with sophistication. You know, if you're a scientific, modern, cosmopolitan person, you're not going to have faith and believe in what they call sky fairies. And of course, we also know that Christianity gets a lot of bad press, and that's not accidental. That again goes back to those pseudo elites and their hatred for Christianity. And then there's another factor, though, Christian, and this is something I've written about for years, and this is really important to understand. A lot of people will ask, well, why do we see all of these evangelical youth, for instance, falling away from the church in their teens? And they discuss everything but one very significant thing, and that's that these people don't believe in truth. They're moral relativists. Now, how do we know this? Experience tells us that, but also there was a Barna Group research survey in 2002, and there's been one since then as well, that really vindicated my assessment. And what it found, Christian, is that only 6% of teens believe that truth is absolute, that there are absolute answers to moral questions. Among born-again teens, what was the percentage? Must be a lot higher, right? Actually, the percentage was 9% among born-again teens, supposedly born-again. Now, why does this matter? It matters because it strikes at the very heart of Christianity, because why did Jesus come, Christianity teaches? Well, he came to save us from our sins, right? But that presupposes that there is truth, that sin exists. But if there is no truth and everything is relative, then there is no sin. There are just preferences, opinions, different positions. And then, of course, there was no reason for Jesus to die on the cross. So if you've come to believe that all is relative, why would you constrain your life and limit yourself with Christian teaching? Why would you do that? I mean, if I believe that, maybe I'd rather become a hedonist, or at least a Unitarian. But that's something that people overlook. And I'm not saying here, I want to be clear, that everyone thinks this through philosophically. Not at all. Most people are not philosophers. What I'm saying, Christian, is that people embrace this relativism. It's inculcated into them on an emotional level. And then they just naturally, instinctively react the way they do. And it's very significant. And it's why the ancient Greeks pointed out correctly that philosophy lies at the heart of everything. If people don't have a sound and proper intellectual foundation, then they're going to go awry. They're going to get the secondary things wrong if they get the first things wrong. And today, of course, we do not at all instill kids with a proper philosophical foundation.
So do you think it's getting harder for young people who are Christian to be Christian in a society where you have all these social pressures from the internet, you have academia treating Christianity as a as an uneducated thought? And when you look at those who have college degrees versus those who don't have college degrees, which I usually, anytime I see that in a statistic, I usually think of those who are brainwashed versus those who are non-brainwashed at government education camps. But those who tend to go to college, you have young people who come from Christian homes and they lose that faith while attending a state university, a secular college, even some Christian seminaries where you have some professors who doubt the inerrancy of the Word of God and they're destroying the faith of the young people. So do you see it at, well, better yet, how difficult would you say it is to be a Christian for a young person today entering this secular world?
Well, it can be very difficult, as you know, especially if you're an authentic Christian, where you really embrace authentic Christian dogma. Now, if you just say you're Christian, but you're very worldly and you embrace wokeism, political correctness, maybe that's a different story. But this harks back to what that British professor said. People are social beings. They are by nature. So if you send a young person into a secular environment like that, well, he wants to be accepted if he's a normal human being. And yeah, the social pressure to dispense with Christianity is absolutely very, very profound. Now, this said, Christian, there is a positive side here, a bright side. What we have seen in more recent times is that secularism now has become part and parcel of the establishment. And so much so that embracing Christianity can become rebellion. And of course, young people are often enticed by rebellion. So I think you also do see now some young people who are pushing back against this woke atmosphere. not just by embracing so-called conservatism, but also in certain cases, I'm not saying a lot, but certain cases, embracing authentic Christianity. And we can only hope that that movement grows, you know, because it's very, very important. And there is a little more good news as well, I'll point out. We're talking about the decline in Christianity, but remember, this is a phenomenon in the West. It's declining in the West, but the West is declining. If you look at worldwide what's going on, professional demographers, Christian, tell us, and have been for a long time, that the world over the next three decades is actually poised to become more religious. Now, why is that? How could that be? Well, it's simply because the West is not the whole world, and also secular people tend not to reproduce. They have very low fertility rates. The people who are reproducing robustly are the devout believers, whether they're Christians, Jewish people, or Muslims. So as it stands right now, Christianity is growing worldwide. That's the good news. The only thing is, though, Islam is probably growing more than Christianity is. But I'll point something else out here that most people wouldn't expect, something else from the everything you know is not so file. Even Catholicism, the last I saw, was growing worldwide at a rate slightly in excess of the rate of population growth. So the West is in trouble, but religion, of course, will live on. And as Jesus said, on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. And I think that we can take to the bank, but the West is a different story. The gates of hell may prevail against it if we don't get our act together.
Well, there's always that faithful remnant that will always keep the word of Christ going through. And no matter how government tries to stamp out and persecute Christianity, it seems that historically Christianity thrives when under persecution. And while the numbers may be that China is the most atheistic country, it may surprise us to know the actual number of Christians that belong to the underground churches in places like China and other persecuted places. So it could be that in the future, in the Occidental world, Christianity far surpasses Christianity in the West, and then we have missionaries from the third world nations, Occidental nations, coming over and witnessing here. So as long as there's always that faithful remnant, there's always hope.
Yeah, absolutely. And this brings something to mind. The great G.K. Chesterton said, I think, that Christianity, by all appearances, died in history about five times. And all the naysayers were saying, oh, well, the faith appears to be going to the dogs. But in each case, it was the dog that died. That's how Chesterton put it. So every dog has his day. But the truth is this, the truth will out. A lie has speed, but truth has endurance. Christianity will survive because it happens to be true. And God not only will win, he has already won, because God is outside of time. Time is a handy illusion, as Albert Einstein put it. So take heart in that and fight the good fight. And I'll just leave you with this. There's another factor. We say might makes right, but it's also true, I learned, that right makes might. If you know that you're correct, not just right because people are saying so or they're voting for you, but eternally, absolutely right, that gives you strength. That enlivens you. It gives you a reason to go on and a reason to live. And you can't really live unless you've found something to die for.
That's right. Amen. Take care. Thank you for your time, Selwyn.
God bless, Chris.
God bless you, too.
As a lumberjack, my job is pretty straightforward. I see the wood, I chop the wood. We even hear crazy ideas on how kids should learn.
Visit thenewamerican.com for real news you can trust.
And to complete today's show, Joe Wolverton and Christian Gomez discuss the COS's guidelines for proposing amendments to the Constitution, noting that the guidelines provide no assurance that a modern-day constitutional convention would not propose bad amendments. The solution, they agree, is to enforce the Constitution. Let's listen in to what they have to say.
This is Christian Gomez for the New American Magazine. And again, we're joined by Joe Wolverton, author and writer for the New American Magazine. Joe, it's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Christian, it's very kind of you to say. Thank you, sir. I love being here.
So back on June 28th, you wrote an article. And like all of your articles, I again encourage everyone who's watching to read these articles. But you wrote one article on June 28th titled, Convention of States, Guidelines for Writing Amendments to the Constitution. And in your article, you were responding to a blog post that appeared on the COS website, in which they called, well, the author of that article called for or described it as being 7 guidelines for drafting proposed amendments. So obviously, COS is trying to reassure its supporters, whether citizens and legislators, that we know what's going to happen at the convention and this is how you should do it. But what's wrong with these guidelines that COS has posted on their website?
Well, just one thing before the guidelines is the fact that they created this, hey, propose amendments that we can bring to the convention. Again, reinforcing this incorrect idea that we, the people, will control the convention. Hey, you know, Joe America, send in a proposed amendment and here's the guidelines. And as long as you stick to the guidelines, you're going to become an amendment writer, pal. It's like, I don't know what, you know, that's to reinforce their idea that it's not a multi-million dollar corporation pushing this. But so their guidelines are saying, basically, if you want to write an amendment for us to consider at this convention that we want to call, here are some guidelines for you to follow. And they start by saying, their first guideline is it has to regulate government activity, not private activity. And they go on and they say, for example, the 18th Amendment is terrible because it regulates private activity, not government activity, because it's the prohibition. Now, I don't know if they have someone who's vetting these articles, but to then go on and describe how we the people, or how the state legislatures or state conventions for ratification would never agree to a horrible amendment the way our opponents say that could happen. They quote that they're using the 18th Amendment. Maybe don't use one of the examples of a horrible amendment that was ratified in your blog post supporting an amendment and claims a horrible one would never be ratified. Because not only did the states ratify the 18th Amendment, they ratified the 16th Amendment.
The income tax. You're,
so don't get in here and say the states would never agree to something so radical. Our opponents are just creating straw men. The 16th Amendment is not a straw man, Christian. The 16th Amendment takes a third of my wages every 2 weeks. That's not a straw man. And that was passed. The 17th Amendment completely turned inside out the federal structure created by the Constitution. That's not a straw man. Okay? You can go and see for yourself that the states very much have ratified terrible amendments that have eaten at the very core of the Constitution. So to use the 18th as an example, just don't mention the things that would contradict your own message.
And while someone might make the case, well, that was almost 100 years ago, there's no recent examples of anything like that. One could always point to the number of states that have ratified the ERA. This is happening even right now with Democratic-controlled states reattempting to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. And if you were to ignore the rescissions like the ERA advocates would have you do, then you have enough states to have ratified it already. If you ignore the rescissions and the deadline.
And anyone can pay attention and see that if there were a convention today, like we quoted Madison in another episode of the show where he says, are you going to get wiser people than we are? Is that what you're hoping for? So anyone can look and just survey the culture. And even on the right side, the conservative side, there are people willing to compromise with many things that would be shocking to the consciences of our founding fathers and to some of us who still believe that way. For example, I could see them passing something that makes it constitutionally sure that homosexual marriage is legal in the country. Just, we want to shore it up because the Supreme Court keeps attacking it. So we want to, and you can see, you can imagine the people there at that convention saying, you know what, let's give them this one because we want something in return. We want a stronger Second Amendment. And you can see that that's what's going to happen, that sort of give and take. And you'll end up with a constitution that none of us recognize, but there's people that all, I mean, wars kill millions of people, but there's people that get very wealthy from war. And so when you have this convention, if that were to happen, you're going to end up with a constitution that's nothing but Frankenstein constitution. It's going to be parts of what everybody there wants instead of saying what is best for the union. It's going to be what's best for the people who bought my seat at this convention.
Yeah, I imagine that a convention would be a lot of give and take, as you point out. Those who want a balanced budget amendment for fiscal restraints would probably argue with the Democrats, if you let us have this, then we'll let you have an amendment to overturn the Citizens United Supreme Court decision. And of course, I could hear the left saying, well, if you're going to have a fiscal restraints amendment, you have to take Social Security off the table. That'll have to be exempt in your amendment in order for it to get enough support from Democrats. Because back in the 90s, Congress was proposing a balanced budget amendment. Mm-hmm. And it almost looked as though it could have passed out of Congress. It didn't. But the Democrats were tacking amendment after amendment to it to sort of water it down and make it weaker than what the Republicans who wanted the BBA wanted. But that just goes to show you, if that was happening in Congress in the 90s, what would an actual convention look like today in the 21st century where, let's say, a balanced budget amendment for fiscal restraint is being discussed? Would it really provide fiscal restraints, or would it be so watered down in order to gain the support it needs to pass that even if it were part of the Constitution, it would be completely meaningless and all of the loopholes created in it would constitutionalize how the budget would never have to be balanced?
Exactly. That they would find a way. Because guess what, Christian? A balanced budget, I mean, 80%, over 80% of what the Congress does today is completely unconstitutional. So our budget would be 80% smaller today if the Constitution were followed. Well, what's going to make the people that overspend today? You're going to add a paragraph to the Constitution, and suddenly they're going to say, do you know what? You're right. Let's quit doing unconstitutional stuff. No. So how many amendments do you want? A third one? Then there's going to need to be a third one because those dadgum federal officials, they're not sticking to their promises like they promised. So let's have a third convention and a fourth and a fifth. You're never going to have a convention that is going to be, that is going to satisfy everyone. And so what, you know what would happen? It would be just like you said. It would be the give and take, the compromise, the capitulation, and not to mention the fact that every seat there would be bought and paid for by somebody. And then when you get this constitution that is produced from this, then there's going to be that faction of COS that says, we need a third convention because we didn't get that done, and we, the people, need to hold a third convention. It never ends. Because why? Because it's like Algernon Sidney said in his book, Discourses Concerning Government, there would be no tyranny if the people didn't accept tyranny. If you accept tyranny, there's always going to be someone willing to play the role of tyrant. So the fact that congressmen put their hand on a Bible and swear to God to be faithful to the Constitution, they're still going to do that after the COS convention, and they're still going to be liars and blasphemers because they're still going to swear allegiance to the Constitution, and the next day they're still going to vote something that's unconstitutional.
Now, one of the other guidelines that COS is proposing here is that whatever comes out of the convention, whatever's proposed, that it has to be germane to the application. You hear Mark Meckler say this one a lot also on television when he's asked, well, what if they propose stronger gun control to sort of undermine the Second Amendment? or whatever other example you could think of. And he'll say, well, that's not germane to the application, as if somehow the application is binding to the delegates at the convention. What do you say about that supposed guideline that COS is peddling now?
Well, first of all, I germane to the application, as if there's going to be, you know, an Article 5, because that's their you know, foundation. Article 5 doesn't say anything about that. They'd love to refer to these things, but never to Article 5, because Article 5 does not provide that power, first of all. So, because if we're honest with each other, Christian, the original convention, there was that too. It has to be, Congress clearly said, your sole and express authority is to propose amendments that to the Articles of Confederation. And day one, that was thrown out. And so you think somehow the people that are in this second convention are going to be like, oh, it says that we can only do this. Yeah, well, here's what I think about that. And then they start arguing that thing, and being germane to the convention will never come up again. Right? It's just a way to deceive people into supporting it, because somehow they think that by these amendments, which makes no sense to me, but by these amendments, they're going to suddenly magically turn tyrants into statesmen. And it makes no sense at all, and they know that. And so what they have to do is completely appeal to sentiment, to emotion, and to the patriotic sense of people that, I mean, the feds ignore the current Constitution. They ignore the amendments now. They will continue to ignore any amendments we tack on, because we as a people somehow accept tyrants in office. And until we get it out of, you know, it's that thing about you can take people out of the slums, but if you change their hearts, they'll take themselves out of the slums. And so we've got to get it to where the American people are educated enough about the Constitution to know the oaths that these men have already taken, that they're violating these oaths, and hold them to account. And when we do that, we won't need anything added to the Constitution, because the Constitution already places very firm restrictions on the authority of the federal government. We simply need to follow the Constitution and not try to fix the Constitution.
Well said. The solution is to enforce the Constitution. Well, Joe, again, thank you for your time, for joining us here on the program. We wish you the best. God bless and take care.
Thank you, Christian. Same to you, sir.
Okay.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of The New American TV. And remember to visit thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news. You can also watch the show there as well. We'll see you tomorrow.